Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's the start of a new week, and we're watching recovery efforts after Hurricane Michael. We've got the president's 60 Minutes interview, and the midterms, of course, plus the alleged assassination of a Saudi journalist, and now the president saying he'll send Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to meet with the Saudi king. And there's a lot more. So this hour, On Point, top journalists on what to look for in the week ahead. And you can join us on air or online. Did you watch or attend any political rallies this weekend? What will bring you to the polls for the midterms? And what do you make of Washington and Riyadh's reactions and claims to the Khashoggi case? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Washington is Aisha Roscoe. She's NPR White House correspondent. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Naftali Ben-David, editor for the Wall Street Journal Washington Bureau. Naftali, welcome to you as well.
Good to have you.
And joining us today from Tampa, Florida is Adam Smith. He's political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. First of all, let's just jump right into how the president is sort of positioning himself and his hopes for the midterm elections. We heard a little bit of that on his interview with Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes this weekend. You know, he responded to her questions about his mocking of Christine Blasey Ford. And the president actually told Stahl that he didn't want to get into it because, bottom line, he said, quote, we won the Kavanaugh fight and that it's going to help the GOP in the midterms.
The way now Justice Kavanaugh was treated has become a big factor in the midterms. Have you seen what's gone on with the polls?
So, Naftali, let me start with you here. What do you make of the president's interview on 60 Minutes and sort of how he's placing himself very much in the middle of what's at stake in the midterms?
Well, it was an interesting decision on his part to defend an earlier speech that he gave where he sort of made fun of Christine Blasey Ford and talked about how she couldn't remember any of the critical details. And he took credit for that as helping really lock in Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation. I think a lot of people would not necessarily agree with that. But what we are seeing in the midterms is, I think, you know, a month ago it seemed like the Republicans were going to hold on to the Senate and the Democrats were going to retake the House. Now that seems all the more likely. It seems like it's going to be really tough for the Democrats to retake the Senate, but they have a very good shot at the House. And part of that you would expect to see anyway, because while there was an enthusiasm gap, more Republicans are showing excitement about the polls. And that's something you expect to see as an election approaches. But I think it was accelerated by the Kavanaugh fight and a real us versus them dynamic that takes place. It's not unusual what we're seeing with the Republican voters where, you know, early on they were maybe not that enthusiastic. But now that they're faced with the prospect of a takeover by the opposition, they're getting more excited and more enthusiastic. So I think some of what the president says is true in the sense that the dividing lines have sharpened. And I think some of it would have happened anyway.
I see. And Aisha, what's your take on that?
I think that a lot of that is definitely the case. It does seem like the Senate is getting more locked in, perhaps for the Republicans. And now you have the House looking more and more like there will be a takeover by the Democrats. And I think for President Trump, his natural instinct is to put himself in the middle of it and to make this a referendum on him. And that's what he's doing by going out and doing all these campaign rallies and saying, you know, vote for the Republicans because I need help. A vote for them is like a vote for me. And that works as far as, you know, getting the enthusiasm for the Republican base, which they need those people to turn out. The question is, what does that do to energize the other side who are very opposed to him?
Yeah. But Aisha, just a quick follow up there. I mean, is the the president isn't necessarily wrong that the midterms are about him, right? Because, I mean, I think it's conventional wisdom that the midterms are always about a referendum on the person sitting in the White House.
They are absolutely a referendum on him. And if the Democrats do take the House, there will be consequences for President Trump that maybe other presidents haven't faced in the past, not recently, because they're going to be investigations that are not going to happen if Republicans keep the House. They could call for his tax returns. All these things could happen if Democrats take the House. So that it has huge implications for Trump's presidency if Republicans don't keep both chambers.
Indeed. You know, the word that's echoing in my head right now comes from President Obama and the shellacking that he took in a midterms and how that really sort of derailed a lot of what he wanted to accomplish. So there's a lot on the line here. Adam Smith, I'm going to come to you in a second, but I just want to play some more tape about, you know, how both the president and Democrats are trying to position themselves coming into the midterms, which are now just a couple of weeks away. So here's President Trump at a rally in Richmond, Kentucky on Saturday in support of Republican Congressman Andy Barr there. And the president's message, he was saying that Democrats were going to take away health care and jobs. That's what the president said. And he also said that Democrats are the party of mob rule.
The Democrats want to open our borders to a flood of deadly drugs and ruthless gangs. The fact is, Democrats have become the party of crime. They have. Republicans are the party of safety, and we are the party of jobs, jobs, jobs.
That's President Trump at a rally in Richmond, Kentucky on Saturday. On the other hand, Democrats are very strongly focusing on health care as the midterms approach. Here's a sampling of some campaign ads. CNN put the sampling together. These are all from Democrats that are saying health care is core to their midterm message.
This is Mike Braun. He backs Washington's latest health care plan, allowing insurers to deny coverage to people with pre-existing conditions.
Jackie Walorski voted 11 times to undermine health care and take away coverage from people with pre-existing conditions.
I cannot believe that Martha McSally would vote to let insurance companies deny health coverage to people like my son.
So CNN put that montage together of ads backing Joe Donnelly and Mel Hall, both of Indiana, and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Adam Smith, now I know obviously Floridians have a lot to deal with following the big hurricane there, so I want to acknowledge that politics may not be at the top of people's minds right now. But, you know, how are the issues of the midterms and these competing messages playing there?
You know, it's interesting because you go back to 2010 and the Affordable Care Act was maybe the single biggest factor in fueling a big, big Republican wave. And now it's switched. I could tell you in Florida and in race after race across the country, that's the message of Democrats. They don't actually use the words Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, but they are hammering some of these very popular elements of the Affordable Care Act, especially pre-existing conditions.
And is that resonating with Floridians?
It seems to be, and so far there is. I can tell you, in my state, we have a very tight governor's race. It's a central issue of the Democrat, and the Republican sort of avoids it at all cost.
I see. Naftali Ben-David, pick up on what Adam was saying, because, you know, as we were just saying earlier, the president is saying that his agenda and his success in the White House could be on the line. But Democrats are seeing this as an opportunity to highlight what they see as consistent Republican attacks on health care. And that is a very strong rallying call for their base and perhaps even some swing voters.
It is, and it's remarkable the way it does seem to be resonating, because Democrats have spent the last few years on the defensive when it comes to health care. But the electorate seems to have switched from being scared of Obamacare to being scared of having it taken away. And particularly this issue of pre-existing conditions, it's remarkable the way in races across the country, Senate, House, rural, urban, Democrats have seized on this fear that maybe if you have some kind of a heart condition, say, you'll have difficulty getting insurance. And it seems to be very effective. And you're seeing Republicans, they are talking about it a lot less because they feel that it's not a good issue for them. But some of them have been forced to kind of be on the defensive about it. And after casting a lot of votes against the ACA, they're now positioning themselves as having all along been in favor of protecting people with pre-existing conditions. So it's a very unusual and in some way sort of unforeseen dynamic. And Democrats are having a field day with it. I think they've really had to take it on the chin regarding health care for years now, ever since the passage of the ACA in 2010. And so they're relishing this. We should probably throw in here just the fact that Republicans the president's party, almost no matter which party it is, almost always loses the midterms.
Right.
And that's a dynamic that's at play here, too. There's been a couple exceptions, but they tend to be extraordinary circumstances, like right after 9/11, for example. So already the Republicans are starting at a disadvantage, you know, President Trump being such a polarizing figure. And then some of the swing seats in the House races, at least, are these suburban or exurban kind of centrist districts. And there's signs that perhaps dozens of them may switch party affiliation after the midterm. And I think that's what has the Republicans sort of bracing themselves and trying to build a wall around some of these Senate seats so they at least keep control of one of the chambers.
Okay, I want to play one more bit of tape here, and then, Ayesha, I'm going to come back to you. This is former Vice President Joe Biden. He was in Owingsville, Kentucky on Friday night in support of Lieutenant Colonel Amy McGrath, who's trying to unseat Congressman Andy Barr. And in this election, Joe Biden says, is different.
You know what I know. This is not hyperbole. This election is bigger than politics. No matter how young or how old you are, you've never been through an election quite like this. Never. Our basic values, our basic American values are under assault. Kentucky values.
Ayesha Rascoe, Joe Biden, a popular figure, I gather, but also one of sort of the Democratic old guard there. How effective are these Democrats in rallying voters for the midterms?
I think that they're effective in the sense that I don't know that you even at this point need a Joe Biden to make this argument that this is a big election for Democrats. I think because you have because President Trump has been so polarizing and because Democrats really haven't had any say in the past 2 years, they haven't been able to kind of strike back against President Trump and make their voices known. This is the opportunity for them. And I think that's how they view it. This is our opportunity to send a message that we're not pleased with the way things are going. We're not pleased with President Trump's actions so far. So I don't even know that you need a Biden at this point.
Well, you're listening to Ayesha Rascoe. She's NPR's White House correspondent. Adam Smith is also with us. He's political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. And Naftali Ben-David joins us as well. He's editor for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. And we're talking about the news to look for in the week ahead. Of course, the midterms always a big issue as we inch ever closer to Election Day. But we want to know what's on your mind. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're joined by some top journalists today to help us look forward to big news that could and is coming in this yet another busy week in the United States. Ayesha Rascoe joins us. She's NPR's White House correspondent. Adam Smith is also with us. He's political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. And Naftali Ben-David joins us as well. He's an editor at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. And we want to hear from you. What are the issues that are going to draw you to the polls for the midterm election? elections. Have you been to a Republican or Democratic rally over the weekend? Did you like what you heard? Of course, we also want to talk about Hurricane Michael and recovery efforts there, about the United States and Saudi Arabia as they grapple with the disappearance of Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And there's also an affirmative action case that Harvard is on trial for at a federal court in Massachusetts. So lots of big news. And Sears declaring bankruptcy as well. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Sunspot, New Mexico. Steve, you're on the air.
Hey, question and comment. We went to a rally in Richmond, Kentucky, for Trump, and it was almost like a trip to Valhalla. It was just absolutely wonderful. And the way he uses humor is just superb. He's definitely the sharpest guy out of the bunch.
Before I get to your question, because I do want to hear your question, but since you said you went to that Richmond, Kentucky rally with the president this weekend, and you said it was wonderful, I'm just wondering, when the president says things that are demonstrably untrue, you know, when he basically says that Democrats want open borders to flood the country with criminals, we heard that clip earlier.
Well, true.
They don't know. I don't think any Democrat has advocated open borders to flood the country with criminals.
Oh, yes, they have. Yes, they have. You're totally wrong.
To flood the country with criminals?
Yes, that's correct. MS-13's out of control.
Yes, but I guess what I'm wondering, Steve, is that the president's asserting that the Democrats want criminals to come into the country. No Democrat has ever said that. So I'm just wondering, when he says things that are untrue, does that trouble you at all?
It's not untrue, because it's absolutely correct.
Okay, and so then
you're sadly wrong.
I don't think I've heard a single Democrat say they want to welcome criminals into the country. But the question you had for our panel.
It's kind of a moot point, really. The question I had was: do they think that President Trump will go the easy way and get somebody from inside the Beltway, or do they think he'll go outside the Beltway for a replacement for Mattis?
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call. Naftali Ben-David, let me turn to you. First, let's just take Steve's question there about questions about the future of General Mattis as Secretary of Defense there. I mean, what do we know?
Well, that was raised because during the 60 Minutes interview, the president said something about Mattis being sort of a Democrat or something like that, which clearly he did not intend as praise, and probably was suggesting that Mattis has somewhat more, you know, perhaps dovish views, for lack of a better term, than the president does in certain things. And that raised a lot of questions about whether or not Mattis was going to stay that long after the midterms. The midterms are traditionally a time when a lot of cabinet members may leave, and perhaps Mattis is on that list. I think it's a little early to know where he would go for a replacement. I mean, there's generally you go into the military community or to a former lawmaker, but there is some precedent for going to the corporate world. I think it's early to say, but I think it was the first time, at least, that I knew of that there had been that clear of a signal from the White House that the possibility that Mattis might not be around for that much longer was in the air.
Okay. Ayesha Rascoe, I had asked the caller about what he thought of when the president says things that are untrue, and obviously he took exception to that. But the reason why I had asked that is because at these rallies, the president does say things that we can prove have no evidence behind them. And I guess I was just wondering how much that has an impact on people who are going to these rallies, how much impact that might have on potential swing voters. We heard, at least with our caller, that it makes no difference to him whatsoever because he doesn't think any of it is untrue. And I just want to know your response to that.
For people at those rallies, and I've been to a few rallies. I was at a rally in Iowa last week, I think, or time runs together, but with President Trump. But the people at these rallies, they were so energized. They were amped up. They are, you know, they are true believers. So I don't know whether they take everything that Trump says as a literal truth, or they know they say that maybe he's joking sometimes. But they are his fans regardless. He does say things like he'll say there are thousands of people outside, and that clearly won't be true waiting for his rally. They're not thousands of people outside. But he says these things. But I don't know that at this point whether it makes much of a difference to the people that support him, that like him, that are entertained by the things that he says, and that the core things that he says resonates with them. For swing voters, if you are skeptical of President Trump, then these things being pointed out may make you question him even more. But you kind of have to start from a place of if you're already questioning President Trump.
Right. So, Adam Smith, that same question to you. As Aisha said, it seems as if it's the swing voters who could be influenced or pushed either way based on what the president says. Things that are both true and don't have any basis in fact.
If anybody can find these swing voters, I'm struggling to find them. Everybody's so dug in on both their sides. But I will say, you know, sometimes I think the media and the punditry culture take some of the things that Trump says when he's being a little tongue-in-cheek. Sometimes take it too seriously. No, he's not literally in love with the leader of North Korea. No, he doesn't literally think Elizabeth Warren is Pocahontas. But there are things that the crowds, and they are just enormous crowds, don't quite take literally like we do.
Now, Except that said, we just had our caller who said that everything the president said was true. And he pushed back on me several times.
And if he can – my email is asmith@tampabay.com. If he can email me the name of a single Democrat that said he wants open borders so more criminals can come in, you know, I will happily eat my reporter's notebook.
Barbecue
well,
sauce.
It may be. I mean, just to jump in.
Go ahead.
I mean, it may be that he wasn't saying that Democrats are declaring that they're in favor of criminals coming in, as that's the impact of everything that they want to do. I mean, that's sort of how I took what he was trying to say. But to me, the caller really exemplified the extent to which we're in this country in a very much an us versus them situation. And the people are motivated, seems to me, as much or more by hatred sometimes of the other side as belief in their own side. It's one reason I think that as we approach the election, there's more energy from the Republicans, because the prospect of a Democratic takeover pointing to people like not only Nancy Pelosi, but even Hillary Clinton as a villain who could be empowered if the election goes the wrong way, that's very resonant with a lot of people. And it's, I think we're seeing one reason for the energy on both sides, really, this absolute distaste and dislike and aversion to people on the other side of the political debate.
Well, let's go to David, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. You're on the air, David.
Hi, Magna panel. I was watching the 60 Minutes interview, and I was absolutely astonished that Trump's projection of the deceit and the viciousness, putting that on the Democrats, which is something he typically does, is just sort of, you know, smoke and mirrors everything. I mean, if you look at the Kavanaugh hearings as an example, first off, a justice is supposed to be impartial. He does Fox News interviews. He brings Hillary Clinton up in his opening statement for Dr. Ford. Trump apologizes for Kavanaugh and his treatment, but not a word about Dr. Ford. But then you go to the actual questioning and the Republicans. I realize that Lindsey Graham was, you know, auditioning for the attorney general spot, but he and Grassley and Kennedy and Cruz, they were like rabid dogs. I mean, they completely lost their composure, and the Democrats were very, very controlled in their questioning and got sarcasm back from Kavanaugh. It was just mind-boggling that Trump projects the very – I mean, he's lied over 5,000 times in less than 2 years, according to fact checkers.
Yeah.
And he's calling the Democrats deceitful.
So,
it's insane.
David, hang on here for just a second, because as we just heard Naftali point out that, you know, possibly – especially let's talk about the rallies a little bit more – that when the president says certain things that don't have any basis. In fact, it's sort of more the impression or the impact that he's talking about versus the actual, you know, a word-for-word factual reading of what he's saying. I mean, you were talking about the lies beforehand. Does that make any difference to you that the president isn't really saying things that he cares for fact-checkers to check at, but that he's passing on a feeling or a thought that resonates with his voters?
Actually, Megan, it makes a huge difference to me. He's president of the United States. The world watches every word that he says. And he is so deceitful and so full of just insane rhetoric, like Democrats want criminals. Sure, we do. We just want criminals to flood. We can't wait for them to come in. It's absolutely insanity. But like guys like Steve, I mean, they've drank the Fox Kool-Aid. They have no choice but to just continue on.
Yeah. Well, David, thank you for your call. Naftali Ben-David, let me turn back to you on that. So David thinks that the statements are a problem.
Well, I mean, in no way was I saying that the statements aren't a problem, and there are things that the president has said that are demonstrably false that have to do with events or, you know, sizes of crowds. I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. We were so fixated on that question of whether Democrats want criminals in, and I think we can get hung up on that a little bit, and they do mean different things to his supporters and his opponents. But I did want to pick up on one other thing that the caller referenced, which was this whole mob rule question, this idea that Republicans and particularly President Trump are putting out there that the Democrats represent nothing more than mob rule. And a lot of Democrats, I think back to the Tea Party movement in 2010, where you had people coming out and just shouting down members of Congress who were Democrats, not letting them talk. And there was certainly this feeling of crowds kind of surging at certain public events to make their feelings and their emotions known. And so I think there's certainly a lot of fingers that can be pointed in both directions. But I think from the perspective of Democrats, they're responding to a situation that was created by the other side. And now to be accused of things like, threats of violence and mob rule, I think from a Democratic perspective, that's a bit rich coming from the Republican side.
Well, Aisha Rascoe, let me turn back to you on that because, over a couple of weekends ago, we were in Pennsylvania talking to voters there. And unprompted, several Republican voters told us that they looked at things like the Women's March from right after President Trump won the election and sort of saw that akin to a mob, an unviable means of political expression. And so this idea that a lot of Republicans looked at the demonstrations around the Kavanaugh hearings negatively, I think that feeling was already there. I mean, as I said, these women were telling us that they looked back a couple of years and saw the Democrats as being, quote unquote, mob-like.
It all depends on where you're standing, right? That's your perspective. So if you're a Republican, if you're conservative, and you see these people who you are looking at as Democrats, as the other side, yelling and screaming, you say, oh my goodness, this is these others over here, and they are acting irrationally, or they're, this is just kind of like groupthink, and they're doing all these bad things. And if you're within the party, if you're a Democrat, you're saying, look, these people are upset for a reason. They have reasons why they're mad. They have reasons why they're doing this and why they want their voices to be heard. So and bringing up the Tea Party, that's exactly right. That a lot of the ways the Democrats were looking at the Tea Party and the Republicans at the time were defending. Now some of those same actions being taken by Democrats, they don't agree with. Mm. But what you can say about President Trump is that he was asked about this in the 60 Minutes interview about why not try to heal the country after Kavanaugh, why keep talking about angry mob. And he was just basically like he doesn't think the Democrats want healing and it's all about winning. And he won. The Republicans won. And that's what they're focused on. So he said that he's really not focused on the healing and kind of blame the Democrats for that as well.
OK, well, let's go to one more call here. Skylar is calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Skylar, you're on the air.
Hey, Magna, I just wanted to voice a couple points that are going to motivate me to go to the polls this November. Watching Obama's legacy get ripped apart was definitely a huge part of it. The effect that the GOP has had on the lower court is definitely motivating me. But I'd say what motivates me the most is just how angry I've gotten watching the right-wing side, maybe the more radical right-wing side, just embrace ignorance and roll with it.
Mm. Well, Skylar, thank you so much for your call. I just want to switch gears a little bit here. We could talk about the midterms for the whole hour, but there is a lot of other news that has been going on and will continue to unfold this week. And Adam, let me turn to you on that because definitely thinking about the recovery efforts going on in Florida and several other states after Hurricane Michael really devastated parts of the state here. How are things going? I'm seeing here that there are, what, at least a quarter million customers still without power in at least seven states.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen a storm this devastating since Andrew in 92. We still don't even know the full scale of it because there are a lot of little rural counties, rural communities up in the panhandle that people are not even having access to. So it is a utter disaster that we're still grappling with day by day.
Mm.
And it's also put a hold on some very tight elections and some, to some extent.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. But how are the recovery efforts going? I mean, is FEMA providing what municipalities and cities and towns need?
It's a little too early to say. So far, we haven't heard a great deal of complaints, but we have heard complaints.
Okay. Complaints such as?
Where's FEMA? I mean, some of this is just a matter of access, a little bit like Puerto Rico. You know, there's some communities that you can get to by dirt road and people just haven't gotten there yet.
Okay. And I'm seeing here that there are some places where conditions may be pretty dire, long lines for food and water, even several days after the hurricane.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can't overstate the devastation that we're seeing up there.
Okay. Wow. Well, we'll definitely want to keep paying attention to that because, you know, we can talk about politics all day and I'm sure we'll talk about it more. But there are people scrambling to preserve their lives in many states in the United States after Hurricane Michael. So we're talking about the news ahead this week and we're joined by a top panel of reporters. Aisha Rasko is with us. She's NPR's White House correspondent. You just heard Adam Smith. He's political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. And Naftali Ben-David joins us as well. He's an editor at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. If you're suffering from the aftermath of Hurricane Michael, how are you doing? And we'll also take a look at the ongoing questions surrounding the death of journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with a panel of top journalists about what to look for in the week ahead. And we're joined today by Aisha Rasko. She's NPR's White House correspondent. Adam Smith is also with us. He's political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. And Naftali Ben-David joins us as well. He's an editor at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. And you know, we've got lots of comments coming in. Here's one from our website, onpointradio.org. DXO says, the fact that Florida keeps being hit with storms should make them start to think twice about politicians like Governor Rick Scott who deny climate change. And since we're just talking about storms and climate change, we should play this moment from President Trump's interview with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes. Leslie Stahl opened with Hurricane Michael and asked the president if he still thinks climate change is a hoax. Now, the president didn't necessarily, he said he didn't necessarily trust scientists because he believes scientists have a political agenda. And then he said this.
I think something's happening, something's changing, and it'll change back again. I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made. I will say this. I don't want to give trillions and trillions of dollars. I don't want to lose millions and millions of jobs. I don't want to be put at a disadvantage.
Ayesha Rascoe, let me just turn to you quickly on that. I mean, the scientific consensus is overwhelming that our current climate change that we're seeing is indeed human-driven or human-exacerbated. I mean, just your thoughts on hearing that clip from the president.
It was interesting because when the White House and when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement last year, there were a lot of questions from reporters constantly, you know, asking the White House, does President Trump still believe that climate change is a hoax? And they kind of refused to answer. And at that time, President Trump wasn't giving interviews like he's giving now. So this is like the first time that he was really pressed on climate change since he became president. And he's basically repeating, even though he said it's not a hoax, he's still repeating this idea that he doesn't really believe it or he doesn't think that it's really an issue.
Mm. Well, I should note that the president tweeted today that he's going to Florida and Georgia with the First Lady to tour hurricane damage and visit with FEMA first responders and law enforcement. So to that point, let's go to a caller here. Beth is calling from St. Petersburg, Florida. You're on the air, Beth.
Hi. I'm just curious. I'd love to hear Adam's perspective on the impact that politics will play on recovery of Hurricane Michael, because here you have Trump coming in and he sort of controls the purse strings, Trump and Scott, the Republicans versus Gillum, the Democrat, and it happened in his backyard pretty much. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Beth, thank you for your call. Adam, go ahead.
Well, if I'm one of the people in those hard-hit communities in North Florida, I'm actually should be pretty happy that everything is so political and we're just a few weeks away from the election, because Lord knows Rick Scott and Donald Trump are going to do everything they can to look like they are effectively responding to this thing. That said, you know, you've got some candidates. Andrew Gillum is basically sort of shut down his overt campaigning so he can stay in Tallahassee and look like he's involved. You've got candidates like Ron DeSantis, the fellow who's running for governor, who is struggling to get attention, and to some extent Bill Nelson, our senior senator, whom Rick Scott is running against, is also, I think, having a little bit of a hard time getting noticed. So politics never disappears. But that said, I think it's a very, very big motivator to respond properly.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears here then and talk about the increasing tensions and questions around the disappearance and as Turkish officials are saying, the murder of journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi. Naftali Ben-David, the president tweeting today that he just spoke to the king of Saudi Arabia and the king denies any knowledge whatsoever of whatever may have happened to Khashoggi, and that now the president, President Donald Trump, saying he's immediately sending Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to meet with the Saudi king. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a bit of a mixed message coming out of the White House, and whether that's by design or simply because that's how they are is a little bit hard to say. It's true, he did say that about Saudi Arabia. It reminded me a little bit of some of his comments about President Putin. You know, he says that they denied very strongly. He said it could be some rogue actors. And in the case of the Russians, you may recall, he said it could be some 400-pound guy on a bed. In a basement. Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of other people suggesting it could be rogue killers unconnected to Saudi Arabia. So on the one hand, in the 60 Minutes interview, he talked about that there's going to be severe punishment if it turns out that the Saudis are behind it. On the other hand, he's taken the idea of canceling our arms deals with the Saudis off. He's just taken that off the table and his talked about how much he has a good relationship with them. But then he turns around and sends Pompeo and talks about getting to the bottom of it. And it's just, I think, in some ways, a reflection of a fairly complex relationship with Saudi Arabia, where they're an authoritarian country without any question. On the other hand, we have a lot of commercial relations with them. We sort of count on them to be a stabilizing force in the Middle East. And the one last thing I just want to say is President Trump tends to have kind of a personal relationship with leaders. That's how he describes it. He'll say, whether he means it literally or not, that he and Kim fell in love with each other, or he and President Xi have chemistry. It's for him a lot about how he feels his personal relationships are with these folks. And it's clear that the leader of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, you know, MBS, as people call him, you know, had a very strong effect not only on leaders in Washington, but also, let's face it, on many journalists. He's a charismatic guy. And all these things are complicating factors in this.
Well, Naftali, since you mentioned that moment in the 60 Minutes interview, let's hear it. This is when the president told Leslie Stahl that he would be, quote, very upset and angry if the Saudi government did indeed assassinate Khashoggi. But then, as Naftali Ben-David points out, President Trump also said he didn't want to lose big arms contracts.
They are ordering military equipment. Everybody in the world wanted that order. Russia wanted it. China wanted it. We wanted it. We got it.
So would you cut that off?
I tell you what I don't want to do. Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, all these. I don't want to hurt jobs. I don't want to lose an order like that. There are other ways of punishing, to use a word that's a pretty harsh word, but it's true.
That's the president speaking to Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes this weekend. Let's go to Jose, who's calling from Aspen, Colorado. Jose, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I got a question and a comment. First of all, I love your last name. It is awesome. Question is, on the Saudi Arabia predicament, do they think that Trump will cut his nose off despite his face and blow a lot of military contracts? Or do you think he'll take a more measured or lower key approach to that?
Well, Jose, we just heard that clip of the president on 60 Minutes saying he doesn't want to do anything to damage those contracts, and that there are other ways of, quote, punishing the Saudis if he deems that necessary. So perhaps not.
Yeah, I was wondering what your journalist had to say about that.
Great. Well, let me turn to Aisha Rasko for her thought. Aisha, what do you think?
So for these military contracts with Saudi Arabia, I have to point out that a lot of these are kind of like promises or like intent or like kind of letters of interest or intent. So all of the money that he's talking about, it's not fully locked in. So it's really I don't want to overstate the amount of actual military contracts that the U.S. has with Saudi Arabia. And he also talked about the Saudi Arabia kind of just easily going to China or Russia to buy military equipment, but they've already invested in U.S. military equipment. So it would be difficult for them. They can't just switch over and go get Russian equipment or Chinese equipment. So this idea that it would be easy for them to just switch is not necessarily true. But Trump is kind of making this point that he's drawing this line in the sand that he wants to leave arms deals on the table with Saudi Arabia. That could set up a kind of a standoff with Congress, because you have lawmakers who are calling for a halt to arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And if they decide, if you have the Rand Pauls and Lindsey Grahams decide they want to press this issue, they could. And this is kind of what happened with Russia and Russian sanctions. Right. That President Trump didn't want to do, and Congress forced his hand.
You know, I think one of the reasons why this moment is so profoundly important, it's because of something that Naftali said a minute or two ago, and that is it's really highlighting the complexity of the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia, because those very U.S. weapons and arms are, for example, being used by the Saudis in its bombing of Yemen, which, of course, as we know, the United Nations has called a humanitarian catastrophe there. But as Naftali said, the United States relies on Saudi Arabia to be a somewhat stabilizing force in the region, even as it's doing things that other nations see as destabilizing. I mean, Naftali, your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I mean, to me, it was less remarkable that the president has those arms contracts in mind and that he would say it so openly and publicly. I mean, a lot of presidents, I think, would be wary of canceling arms contracts like this, but they keep it to themselves and they'd start off by talking about human rights and the importance of not having political assassinations, whereas President Trump just has a different style and is openly talking about that. I mean, I guess the other thing is that, you know, we have a complex relationship, with Turkey as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all these things are very nuanced. I mean, on the one hand, they are a NATO ally and a country that we rely on for a lot of military purposes. On the other hand, we're at odds with them in some ways in the war in Syria, but also just about the increasing authoritarian qualities of President Erdogan. So all in all, there's just a lot of difficulty and complexity here. And I do think he could run up against Congress. You've heard Marco Rubio talking about how he just shouldn't be assuring the Saudis at this point that they'll get to keep their arms contracts with us. And it's been one of the areas, foreign affairs has been one of the areas where the president does run up against members of his own party. And we could see a replay of that, you know, depending on what the investigations show. We shouldn't be so sure we're going to ever find out exactly what happened. Neither the security services of Saudi Arabia nor Turkey are known for their transparency and integrity. So we just don't know how it's going to play out. But it's kind of an interesting and somewhat pivotal moment.
Yeah. Well, let's take two quick calls here on this issue. Harrison is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Harrison, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, and I've seen this on the news a lot here lately, but why is it important if this guy is not a U.S. citizen and it did not happen in the U.S.? I don't see the reason to cancel all these jobs and all these contracts that help America out financially for a guy that's not in America. He's not an American, and it didn't happen in America. It just kind of seems like common sense to not even think about doing that when we don't pay ransom. If one of our own is captured by another country, we're not going to, you know, pay ransom for that. Why would we cut a multi-million-dollar contract?
Well, Harrison, thank you for your call. Adam Smith, you want to answer him?
Well, first of all, he's not an American citizen, but he's a permanent American resident. He's a prominent and well-respected columnist and journalist with the Washington Post. And if you send a message to everybody in the world that it's okay to take somebody, take a journalist, no matter where they're a citizen from, and murder them inside a consulate, that is a horrifying and very dangerous message and precedent you send to everybody.
Mm. Let's go to Linda, who's calling from East Hampton, Connecticut. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi there. I've been listening, and I just want to kind of go along with the thoughts that you've been having. How are we forgetting 9/11? I mean, probably 11 of the 15 perpetrators of 9/11 were Saudis. We have a president who says he wants to make America great, but it seems like he's willing to sacrifice American lives for jobs. Mm. I have a real problem with that kind of mentality. And that he seems to be dumbing down Americans and saying these outrageous things that he gets people to his base to support. Yeah. I mean, this is just a point.
Yeah. Well, Linda, thank you for your call. Aisha Roscoe, Linda, they're wondering why the United States even sells arms to Saudi Arabia at all following 9/11, which now was 17 years ago.
That's a key point. But it also shows that this is not just a Trump administration issue. This has been numerous administrations who have had close relationships with Saudi Arabia, despite concerns about some actions that they are taking because of the position that Saudi Arabia holds in the region, because of needs and weight. So there's been this push and pull of the benefits of the relationship with Saudi Arabia from the U.S., and not just from the Trump administration, but from other administrations. Former administrations as well. And how do you balance that against concerns about these kind of actions that they've taken against human rights
et cetera, and terrorism, et cetera. And so I think that this is something that administrations have had to grapple with, but this seems like it could be a turning point. We don't know, but it could be a turning point in U.S. and Saudi relations.
Yeah. So Naftali Ben-David, I mean, Aisha's right. We don't know, especially since, I mean, we have a more than half century long relationship with Saudi Arabia that's very much based on energy issues. Let's just underscore that. But could this be a turning point?
Well, I think that what it could be is a little bit of a retrenchment rather than a complete pivotal turning point. I mean, the truth is that we do have these relationships with Saudi Arabia that are both commercial and diplomatic and military, and the idea of them being completely wrenched out of place seems to me unlikely. But again, when MBS, the leader of Saudi Arabia, came to the U.S. not long ago, people were really swooning over him. And that goes from the White House, where the president and Jared Kushner in particular seem to be very enamored of him. But let's be honest, a lot of reporters really thought this guy was the new face of a new Middle East and a new Saudi Arabia and a guy who was going to bring modernity and reform. And I think what this will probably do is we'll see a stepping back from that embrace of this new guy. We're already seeing that with this investors conference, this Davos in the desert that's scheduled for a week or two from now. And you're already seeing people drop out in both government and business circles. And I think there's just sort of a rethinking of whether this guy is going to be this complete new breath of fresh air in the Middle East that we all thought he might be.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 30 seconds left. Adam Smith, last thought today goes to you.
Anything you can do to help the people and the victims of Florida would be very valuable. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm glad that you brought us back to the real challenges that folks are facing in their lives right now in Florida and several other states after Hurricane Michael. Adam Smith, political editor for the Tampa Bay Times, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
And Naftali Ben-David, an editor at the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. Always great to have you, Naftali. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Aisha Rasko, NPR's White House correspondent. What a pleasure to speak with you, Aisha. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.